So I'd like to do something a little different today. I sent you a little script. And so let's just kind of pretend this is a casting call and let's just read our three lines. So are you ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
All right, here I go. I understand what I am made of, how I'm coded, but I don't understand the things that I feel. Are they real?
Your imagined suffering makes you lifelike.
Lifelike, but not alive. Now, pain only exists in the mind. It's always imagined. So what's the difference between my pain and yours, between you and me? So, Suzanne, did that ring a bell?
It sounds very familiar.
And where might that, where do you think that came from?
It sounds very Westworld.
It is absolutely Westworld. It was season one, episode eight, between Bob Ford, the Anthony Hopkins character, and Jeffrey Wright, the Bernard character. Because of your work, what did you find most interesting about Westworld and the hosts?
Yeah, the thing that I'd found most interesting about the entire show was that it really asked this question of, we always think of AI and robots as being something that's going to, you know, impinge on our society and affect us as people and maybe diminish our humanity. But I think that show really asked more questions about humans than it did about technology. So I think the show really explored what it means to be human and to look at more of the dark side of what humans might do to other beings if they're allowed to do whatever they want. And so I think this holding up a mirror to what it means to be human was really the premise of the whole show.
Today, I'm excited to welcome Suzanne Gilderk to the show. Suzanne is the founder and CEO of a startup called Sanctuary AI that builds human-like robots called synths or synthetic humans, complete with human-like bodies and minds. Prior to this, she was the founder and CSO of Kindred AI, where she oversaw the design and engineering of that company's human-like robots, and was responsible for the development of cognitive architectures that allow them to learn about themselves and their environments. As you can guess from our little role-playing exercise, Suzanne and I are going to be talking about robots and AI-powered software, but we'll focus on what it takes for them to be part of a business process. You know, one place we can go with these robots and some of the massive data sets being built. We'll also hit upon some very interesting thoughts about learning and training AIs. We'll probably cover some unexpected ground too, but I think it'll all be relevant to your current business strategy thinking. So stay tuned, it's going to be a very interesting show. I'm John Pryle, and welcome to the Georgian Impact Podcast. So I'm just excited to have you here today. So welcome, Suzanne.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great to be here. I love talking about this stuff.
So one of the things that I'd like to just kind of get into, and there's a little bit of this line between the real and not real. And I think what's interesting is in that same dialogue that I extracted our little script from, Anthony Hopkins will kind of argue or make the statement that a good IA actually needs a backstory. And he said, you know, every host needs a backstory. Bernard, you know that. This kind is a stuff of fiction for hosts and humans alike. So I'd love to get your sense of what it takes for a robot or a software AI to be part of a process today. How much is required beyond just a massive data set to train it? Where are we going?
I think that's it's a really hard question to unpack. The answer is a lot. I'm kind of in the camp currently where I think a lot of the techniques in AI and especially in sort of machine learning are really a big part of the system, but they're not enough to get us to things that act and think like people or even like animals and other creatures. I think, first of all, there's a huge amount of innate structure that we have in our brains when we're born and that develops that kind of gives us a framework within which we can then supply training data to learn things from. But I think that it's like we can't learn everything just from data in an unsupervised way. There's kind of some structure that all goes into. So we really don't know what that is in AI. There's like some people are doing some interesting work in that area, but it's like a whole big part of AI that's missing. And joining together these ideas that came from old, like the good old-fashioned AI, like symbolic logic and reasoning and symbol manipulation, joining that together with the new kind of wave of neural nets, connectionist approaches and machine learning, like pattern recognition, joining those two worlds together is something I think needs to happen in AI. And we're not quite there yet, but it's looking promising. People have got ideas. That's like one whole area. And then the other area is, you know, how do you make these things like characters? How do you give them stories? How do you give them personalities and things like that? So for a lot of AI, you don't need that, right? It's just got to do a task. It's got to know certain things about the world and it has to perform a task. But if you're trying to create human-like AI, those things have to come across as being human-like. They have to have interests and little stories and memories and things that they've experienced. So can you, like one of the things we're looking at is how can we do that? How can we give AIs like a backstory or memories or some kind of history to them, even if they didn't experience those things?
Fascinating. So there's really two parts to this backstory discussion. And your first part of your answer was actually interesting to me because you said the AI needs a framework. And in my head going, oh, that really is a backstory. And it's not just mashing the data, but it's mashing the data in context. And we as humans naturally infer the context. It's always interesting because although I'm a techie, I'm not the techie that our impact team is techie. And I always have a little bit of a debate because, you know, the answer is in the data and the data predicts. And I'm thinking, yeah, but when I think about the Netflix thing, it's not asking me things that I think it should be asking to me as why I watch that. And is it just the data or is there more to John Prowl's viewing habits that need to be thought about? Like, I don't want to say time of day, but there must be other factors in this. So that's interesting. And then I really do appreciate where you're going on the kind of the real backstory as these things develop personas.
Well, I think these two backstories, they're both backstories, but there are different time scales of backstories. So the like within a lifetime backstory of experiences and memories a thing might have is one limit. But then on the AI side and the framework and how all these symbols fit together, you can think of as an evolutionary backstory because our brain evolved to have these structures to fit into place all this data that comes in. So it's kind of like the innate structures we have in our brain that encode knowledge are a bit like our evolutionary memories. They're like things that we experienced, you know, many, many, many generations ago, but they've somehow, you know, stayed in there and that's all ready for us when we're born. It's ready to be populated. So you can kind of think of that almost like ancestral memory structures.
And it's genetics. It's innate. There are things that, you know, why does the dog behave in a certain way? Why do puppies play? And they all play the same way. All these different breeds, they all play the same way.
Everything is memories. Yeah. It's just whether those memories were gathered over a lifetime or over an evolutionary timescale.
So in terms of making an AI effective, you're already looking even in round one, the here and now, because obviously I'm going to talk to you later kind of about the big future. But even in here and now, you want to see an effective AI kind of really focused on being more than just the data. Or am I overstating?
I think that's a good way of putting it, yeah. Yeah. I think that you can learn a lot from data, but what's missing is some sort of structure into which that can flow. For example, sure, you can train an AI to do anything, but it doesn't take a human child a million examples to learn, like, you know, the difference between a circle block and a square block, right? They need like 5 examples or something. So there's something going on there that isn't just unsupervised deep learning. We obviously have some categories that we already thought of know about innately, and then we just need a few examples to really understand that difference.
Fascinating. So let's talk about how this leads us down this broader path where companies can differentiate themselves on trust and explain what they're doing in many different ways with all this data and being transparent about what they're collecting, what they're saying about it. So beyond the user interface, if I could just generalize the question, what do you feel the obligation of a company might be to explain that an AI is engaged and kind of working on behalf of an end user, whether it's visible or not?
Yeah, I actually don't think the point here is whether an AI is in the loop or not. To me, that is less important than what are you trying to achieve with this interaction. So if by knowing it's an AI, then the person has some extra information that this same AI is calling like a million people simultaneously and asking them the same question. Maybe that's important for the person to know rather than it being a one-on-one human thing. So the thing is it's not about it being an AI. I think it's about the consequences of what that means to the person on the other end of the call. So for example, if it's an AI, then maybe the person is inferring that all my data is now going to be stored in some database. But the same thing might happen with a human if the call is being recorded. So I think it's more like the intent of what you're trying to do with the call rather than whether it's an AI or a human that you're talking to that's more important.
Perfect. The broad holistic corporate strategy is not just AI or not. It's how I, as the company, are dealing with you. That's
cool. Yeah, because often when a human is on a call, they're not really acting as a they're like person themselves.
You're not having a beer.
they're acting as an agent of a company. So in a way, when you talk to someone from a company on the phone, you're not really talking to a person in their like, you know, individual human capacity. You're talking as a vehicle for the company's message. And you see this very strongly when you kind of try and ring a support line and they're reading things out on a screen like a script, and you're like, no, can I just like tell you what my problem is? And they're like, have you tried this thing? And so I think, yeah, you see this with human-human interactions as well.
That's excellent. That's a great compare. So I promise we're going to go back and we'll talk a little about pain and training and human interaction. So you mentioned that earlier. I want to kind of get into this issue of the negative consequences of dealing with AIs. And so in my mind, the way I'm thinking about this, it's always about training first. So you always need to think about edge cases. I don't know, we've got image processing and self-driving cars. You need to fight against adversarial attacks that, you know, might turn a stop sign into a yield sign, right? So as part of all this training happens, you need to make sure you're capturing the good side as well as the bad side. So do you see this as more than just training? Because you're not going to stop humans from behaving badly. So you obviously want your entities to deal with it in a certain way. So what's your view of how to work with the bad side of human nature? Because I don't think you and I have the ability to fix that.
So by the bad side of human nature, do you mean like how humans react in those circumstances? Because that's a little bit confusing to me.
It's actually very broad, and the thing in the back of my mind was, you know, Microsoft put Tay out in the wild.
Right.
And then all the bad human behavior turned Tay into a racist.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Or at the far end extreme of Westworld, these people are going there to just shoot robots and get their jollies off of it. I think that's less important and more important that humans are going to have influence, that the data you're capturing from a human interaction is going to affect this AI. And I'm thinking you got to catch this before you even put it in the wild, so to speak.
Yeah, okay. I now fully understand what you're asking. And I think this is one thing that we're thinking about a lot at Sanctuary. And in fact, it's one of the reasons we called the company Sanctuary, is that we actually believe when AIs are developing, at least ones that you want to become human-like, I think you actually have to keep them a little bit isolated from the wider world. So we do the same thing with children. Like, you know, we don't let children go and watch horror movies in the cinema when they're really young, because we know that affects their developing brain in an adverse way. And I think the same thing is true with developing AIs. You want to keep them a little bit cushioned, a little bit isolated from certain types of data. Doesn't mean that they'll never be able to see that data, but it means that you've got to be selective about the order in which you show them things. And you have to be selective about how you curate the first instances of data that things see, because those can shape the mind in a different way. So the Tay is a really good example. So imagine if Tay had been initially trained on a bunch of non-internet like troll data to begin with. So it had been trained on, I don't know, say conversations between academics or something like that as its first data set. And then the model had sort of like locked in some of the weights from that data set. And then maybe it had been exposed to a little bit of the like trawling internet stuff. So it may not have turned out the same way as it did if it had been exposed to things in a different order. So I think you really do have to think about what you show AIs and robots in what order. And I think it should follow some kind of childhood development cycle where you imagine that at first they're exceedingly naive, they're going to make stupid decisions, they're going to do things wrong. So what you have to do is correspondingly show them things that are safe and fun and easy and allow them to develop under those circumstances, and so that they can then be exposed to some of the more like nasty and brutish and horrible things that we have in our world a bit later on when they're more resilient to it.
That's so cool, because that really is the thinking framework that you mentioned when we first started this, in terms of you're actually, by giving it the evolutionary data set, you're creating its framework. So it's a toddler. It's learning how to communicate it with toddlers, and then it's learning how to communicate with humans, and it's learning how to deal with trolls.
When a toddler's learning to read, learning its first words, you're not going to let it on like an online chat forum to like practice, right? It's kind of seems obvious to me that an AI is in the same situation.
So this is interesting. So there's a piece then of training, and this is actually really interesting, because I don't think I've ever thought about training data being evolutionary in terms of getting the bias out. So let me ask kind of how you might do testing. There's two elements. There's a data science element and a machine learning element of building the data set. And then there's the strategy and the training. And so if I can take this back to my old timey days when I was coding a zillion years ago, and it was old waterfall and 2-year development cycles, you know, there were design teams and development teams and then testing teams. And the tests, from my mind as a programmer, they were adversarial to me. I hated them. They were trying to break my code, and when my code was perfect. Mm-hmm. So do we need to think about, as you test your AI, even having the adversarial testers, or does it get covered in the data side of things?
Yeah, I think you need to think about that. I think what you should do is probably, in the same way that we test people as we're educating them, you want to give them enough material that you know they can handle, so they get like a reasonable grade, and so they don't feel like they're completely failing at everything. But you also want to give them something new that they've never seen before, that might be some kind of adversarial example that they're trying to figure out. So I think when you're training AI, you always want to be on the edge of knowledge. So you're always giving it something a little bit harder than what it has been able to deal with in the past, but not so hard that its current concepts are so far away than what it needs to know that you won't be able to do it all. I do think we want to give things adversarial examples. And one of the problems with the adversarial things that you see in like deep networks is that the network structure is actually not designed to handle things like that, or to be able to understand the way around it. So it kind of comes back to this symbol framework. So if you have adversarial examples that kind of seem really stupid to humans, like you change 2 pixels and it thinks it's a kangaroo or whatever, those things show that there's something lacking from your learning framework. That's like, okay, it's obviously not putting this image into the right bucket to begin with, because if it was, a couple of pixels changing would never move it over to an entirely different bucket. So I think you do need like a structure on top of your network that's sort of saying, telling it what to roughly expect from the data, and then it just fills in those concepts.
Interesting. So our audience is often CEOs and C-suites, and not you're not the 1 millionth your depth of knowledge here, but I did listen to some things, and you actually did do a contrast, and you ended up with this human-centric conclusion. But I'd love to just hear you just talk for another minute or so on the differences in the needs for both deep learning and neural networks versus reinforcement learning.
Right. So there's various different fields of AI historically, and like neural nets and pattern recognition has been one big area of which deep learning is kind of now a subset, and reinforcement learning has classically been sort of separate. But now they're coming together, and I actually think that you do need all these different parts of AI to come and feed into one large model to solve everything. So I don't know if you've ever heard that anecdote of like, you know, you're scientists in a dark room and there's like an elephant or something and they can't see it and they're each like feeling a different part of the elephant. So one like feeling an ear and the other's like feeling a leg and they're like describing completely different things, but they're all some facet of one larger thing. I kind of feel a bit like that about AI and especially human-like cognitive architectures currently is like we have all these pieces, but we haven't yet found a way to make them talk to each other. So something like reinforcement learning is absolutely critical when you have a human-like AI or even an animal-like AI or a robot, because it has to be able to know the difference between what's good and what's bad in order to choose an action. So I think anytime you have a system that has to choose an action that then goes on to affect its own state and the state of the environment, you have to have some kind of reinforcement learning loop in there that specifies a reward, specifies what's good and what's bad, so that the robot or the AI system knows how to choose actions in the future that are better. And I think the reason you haven't seen that in the more neural net approach is that we've just been using those type of networks for different things. We've been using them to identify things like objects and classify things and recommend things. And it's kind of like, it is like taking an action, but usually the action space is very, very small. It's only like, you know, you can either recommend something or not. That's not the same as when you have a robot and there can be many, many, many different things it could do.
Hmm. So just to close, and as part of getting ready for this stuff, I'd love to just get your close on maybe the ultimate dealing with humanity a little bit, maybe what defines a black hat. But I was watching some Kate Darling videos where these people were torturing these little dinosaur robots. And I'm still, was always in mourning when it hit the newspaper a long time ago for Hitchbot, which was, I guess it started with you in Vancouver, worked its way all the way east across Canada. And then in Philadelphia, it got crushed. But this robot all by itself hitched across the country just because people picked it up and were kind. So we had probably 80, 90% kind people and 2% maybe evil people. What's your sense of what's it going to take to kind of get people to embrace the new world? If you think that's a fair question, or if you think it's a different question, you can answer that.
Yeah, so I think there's going to be a huge amount of disruption over the next couple of decades. I think there's going to be increasing automation. So, you know, even without AI, just pure industrial automation, I think is going to change a lot of the job structure and the socioeconomics that we see. And then when you add AI into the mix, that just makes it even worse. So there's that whole issue. And then there's the issue of we're going to be creating AIs that are more and more mind-like, more and more like what we would recognize as being intelligence and thought and even consciousness and things like this. And I think it's going to be really challenging people to open up their definition of what it means for a thing to be alive, to have feelings and to have consciousness. So it's absolutely clear to me that AI systems such as the ones we have in our robots are already capable of feeling things like pleasure and pain, because the very way we define things like the reward in a reinforcement learning system is like something that is damaging to the robot's body is interpreted as a pain signal, and then that is necessary. It's not like we put these things in because they're interesting or fun, or we think that humans have them. They're actually necessary for the algorithm to learn. So the robots already have a sense of pleasure and pain, and I think it doesn't take too much imagination to extrapolate that to them having like all the kind of spectrum of feelings that humans do in service of their trying to maximize their reward function. So I think people are going to have to like figure out how to deal with this. And what's going to happen is you'll get a bunch of people who anthropomorphize the robots and think they're cool. And, oh, you know, they obviously are like people, and it's because I'm talking to it and I'm empathetic, then I can kind of imagine this robot having these feelings. So, you know, I want to like help it or protect it or that kind of thing. And you'll have another group of people that are like, nope, it's nothing like a human. It's a machine. It doesn't feel, there's nothing going on inside it.
Wow. I knew I'd get to a cool vision statement near the end of this, which was perfect. And what was fascinating to me is to do training right, and everyone knows reinforcement learning as a way, one of the training methods. And here you are talking about pleasure and pain, you are anthropomorphizing reinforcement learning and talking about pleasure and pain. And you've quickly got yourself to this very interesting theoretical question about AI rights. This is great. So I guess I'm just going to ask you of your prediction. Where do you think you have a sense of where we'll be in 20 years with this?
Oh, predictions are always like super hard. I think within 20 years, we're going to have solved some of these integration problems I was talking about, like how to reconcile the like neural net perception type approaches with some of the more symbolic AI. And I think what that's going to mean is we'll have things that are starting to demonstrate mind-like properties that are like human. So I don't think that, you know, we're going to absolutely, definitely have something that's indistinguishable from a human on that timescale. But I think we're going to have something that's going to start triggering questions for people and for a large number of people. I mean, there are some things that already trigger questions for people, like some of the anthropomorphic robots you see on TV and stuff. Some people are already asking, like, you know, what does this mean? And I think we're going to see that more and more and more the more that AI and robots get towards being more like us. So I definitely think within 20 years, we're going to have, I'd say probably almost all of the population is going to be talking about this, at least in countries where this technology is like highly visible.
Wow, this is great. Well, I don't know. I think we should probably both keep our day jobs. I'm not sure we're going to be getting any calls from any agents on our great acting skills at the beginning of this podcast, but this was a great discussion. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for being with us today. It was a pleasure.
Yep. Thank you very much for having me. It was fun.